This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
We have found, we have planted, we have gathered into barns, done the same work as the men, who with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factory.
Tell it, Bev Grant. We were there. We were there. We are there. Novelist and community historian Ellie Bilow gave me a wonderful read, High Voltage Women, Breaking Barriers at Seattle Light, telling the story of 10 women electrical trade trainees and their fight against intense, long-running discrimination at Seattle's public utility. Now, the book is a riveting account of what it's like for women and people of color breaking into a segregated workforce. Their strength, their dignity, their growing confidence radiate through. They are my sheroes because we were there.
Then we'll hear from Megan Cornish with her gripping story of a multiracial group of women who put their bodies on the line to gain a foothold in the male and largely white electrical trades at Seattle's publicly owned utility in the 1970s, and how these women implemented affirmative action in the face of life-threatening sexism and racism, because
we were there. Ellie, thank you to be with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
Let's talk about this gripping story of this multiracial group of women who put their bodies on the line to gain a foothold in the male and largely white electrical trades at Seattle's public-owned utility, and this was in the 1970s. This was affirmative action in the face of really life-threatening sexism and racism. So I don't know if you want to start particularly with the story of maybe Clara Frazier.
So Clara Frazier was a longtime activist in the Seattle community who had come up under HUD taking on and incorporating affirmative action through a number of programs in Seattle. And Seattle as a city was under the gun in the early 70s because of its own racism, in particular sexism was charged later. But they were under federal court mandates to start stepping up affirmative action programs in order to get federal funding for infrastructure. The City Light, which is a publicly owned utility, hired this activist thinking that she would kind of go in her corner and come up with something fairly innocuous as a program to bring women into the electrical trade. Anyone who knew Clara Frazier knew she was not going to stay in the corner. She didn't. She designed this program facing ever mounting opposition. The more she stepped up, the more the administrators of the utility were sorry they had hired her and started to look at ways to fire her. But she did create this program for 10 women to break into the electrical trades.
But the coming together of feminist issues, of civil rights issues and labor issues, trying to create this program and these really heroic women.
It did indeed. When this program was initiated, over 300 women applied for the opportunity to be in this program. These are the people who work with high voltage lines, go up the power poles, and deal with whatever is mounted on them, the equipment. This was the first opening for women. 300 women applied. 10 women were chosen. It was mixed racially in terms of there was one Asian woman, two black women, one Chicana. It was mixed in terms of gender identification, gay and straight. It was mixed in terms of economic class. All the women were poor, and some had more education and opportunities than others. The program fell apart almost before it started in terms of what it had promised. So these women were put out to begin work before they'd gotten their first paycheck, so they didn't even have money to buy the work clothes that were required for the job. That was the start of it. The administration, all white, all male, at the top level, did not see this coming. They had thought they would be able to placate liberal Seattle with the program, not with the actual women. They hadn't really thought what was going to be like when they actually had women on the work site.
Well, to get back to Clara Fraser, so here's this woman.
Right.
There were groups like Freedom Socialist Party, and this was a real political onslaught that, again, really brought together the issues of discrimination and civil rights and labor rights and gender. God, did she face the wrath of management. Talk a little bit more about how that actually happened. And she went on to sue the city for discrimination on the basis of sex and political ideology.
And the 10 ETTs, or what they call the trainees, they also brought a claim for sex discrimination, it was called at the time. Now, Clara Fraser, they were after her from the beginning, as I said, as she designed the program, and then as she tried to carry it out. And it was insidious administrative harassment for her, which is why she added the political harassment. She was a known activist, but that didn't stop them from pursuing her. And so they charged her with things she hadn't done in terms of her actual work. They took her off the program as soon as the women came on and were actually in the field. They transferred her off the program so that the trainees had no administrative support. Clara Fraser was a member of the Radical Women, and so were three of the women who were chosen to be in the trainees. They led the political charge, challenging the city and the city-owned utility, both in court and on the work site. The 10 women were not in total solidarity in the sense of they were not all political activists. They were activists in the sense that they wanted the same kind of pay and the same kind of treatment on the work site as the men who had the jobs.
Again, I'm glad that you mentioned that there were members of Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party. This is the kind of thing that when you talk about being a socialist, these kind of programs and these kind of things and living it are what we who consider ourselves to be socialists should be advocating. Talk about Heidi Durham, who was another one of the trainees, and the kind of job harassment that she failed, because we really have to understand what these women did. Their actions were thoroughly political and bucked a racist, a system of gender bias to really open up opportunities which still have not been, the door has not fully been kicked in yet. But talk about Heidi Durham and her role in all of this.
Heidi Durham was the youngest of the 10 women that came in on this program. She was 21 when she came on. She was a member of the Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party. She came on ready to work. They all faced quite a bit of discrimination as they were being trained. Heidi got herself, after much legal maneuvering, was finally allowed to move into training as an apprentice for a line worker. This is the pole work and the high voltage. On the job, she was harassed. She was given work reports and evaluations by one job site leader that were untrue and put greater pressure on her. So on a particular day, she was told to climb these poles up and down with the spikes on her feet and keep up with two guys in a lift truck with a bucket. So she was supposed to be running up and down these poles as fast as these two experienced guys in a bucket truck. She kept up. She went up. She was coming down. One of her hooks, one of the spikes, hit a knot in the wood and did not bite in. The other one was not fully engaged, and she fell some 30 to 40 feet, broke her back, life-threatening injury. This is at age 22. She eventually managed to get herself back, but in the interim, in addition to this fall that I think was based on harassment, one of her co-workers, Megan Cornish, was out on a crew. They heard on their truck radio that someone had been hurt. They went and called in to find out who it was. They found out it was Heidi, and a co-worker of Megan's turned to her and said, "Oh, too bad. Your friend fall down, go boom, boom." Heidi was crippled for life and never went back to the line worker apprenticeship, but eventually through legal pressure was hired back on City Light and became basically managed power at a desk job.
And of course, what Heidi also did, not even daunted by this terrifying, life-crippling injury, this socialist woman participated in the IBEW Local 77, and they pushed it forward. And I want you to talk about that, too. So it was management, male dominance, and misogyny that harassed, but it was also their efforts to educate their unions.
And there was a lot of educating to be done. It was IBEW, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and at the beginning, the union it was Clara Fraser that managed to set it up where the trainees, the ETTs from the beginning of the program, were their own unit within the local, which was brilliant. But the local didn't really want them until the harassment became so obvious. They were given this loyalty oath letter while in training saying, if you don't sign this letter, you're gone. And the letter says, I will either cooperate with whatever the utility comes up with for a program or I'll quit right now. Finally, the local said, don't sign that letter. Put this qualifier on the bottom and sign over to the side. That was the first time IBEW stepped up. Over time, when Heidi's injury happened, the first report that went through the union, the accident report, the union signed off on one saying that it was her own fault for not being a good worker, which, you know, so, but by the end, they actually gave these buttons to the women who survived this whole program. The local honored with a plaque and buttons, radical social bitches is what the button said, and men and women in the local probably wore those buttons and still do.
Really, bravo for this story, and I love the way you described yourself. You're a novelist and you're a community historian. That makes the history a living reality. This book it's a story about the past, but it's the present and the future.
And as you said, the reason I call myself a community historian is because I'm interested in the interaction of people who identify and work together towards something for at least a period of time. I am sorry I can not say this is a Cinderella tale and everything turned out fine and the numbers are all different and everybody's happy at Seattle City Light. There's new actions being taken about discrimination at City Light to this day, and we're talking almost 50 years later. However, there is a change on the work site, and I think it's interesting within the union community, especially the trades, there is a shift, and I think it has to do with the first women coming in and the first people of color coming in, where for the first time the so-called FBI of the unions, fathers, brothers, and in-laws, has started to recognize that women and people of color, oh, that's like my daughter. Oh, that's like the person my kids know. So, and in actually working with people different than themselves, I think there's the traditional union movement begun to understand that it is all of us and not just the FBI, the fathers, brothers, and in-laws. So I view that as a major step forward.
Now, this book is an absolute handbook for political savvy organizing. It's an also inspiring testament, really, to the tenacity and bravery and pure grit of the trainees who stood their ground, did their jobs, and made history. And read High Voltage Women, Breaking Barriers at Seattle City Light. My dear sister Ellie Ballou is a great novelist and a great community historian and melds the two. Thank you, my dear sister. You're coming into town.
I am not. Megan Cornish, one of the actual trainees, is coming into town.
Megan Cornish, one of the City Light groundbreaker workers, one of our sheroes, to get a broader view of what real sheroes are. Sisters who have made waves and broke ground from the grassroots. Megan Cornish.
I want to thank Ellie Ballou for her masterful capturing of the history of this groundbreaking electrical trades trainee program for women at Seattle City Light. She brought it to life by doing a terrific job of reaching out and interviewing so many of the participants in this struggle. She also mastered the extensive documentation of that fight. I also want to give tribute to those who most made the success of the Electrical Trades Training Program possible. First, of course, Clara Fraser, who founded socialist feminism as a distinct political theory, as well as two organizations to put that theory into practice, Freedom Socialist Party and Radical Women. She was also a trainer and an employment expert with the federal anti-poverty program that existed for a few years during the Johnson years. From the start, management knew she was a Marxist and a civil rights militant. They needed those skills to make the program successful. Then I want to hail Heidi Durham. Heidi, as a line worker apprentice, suffered the fall from a pole that broke her back. Her indomitable spirit and leadership started with her refusal to let that accident crush her. Her fight within the union not to be scapegoated for her own accident, and her fight to force management to keep her in the trade. They wanted to make her a secretary, believe it or not. After all that, she went on to become a leader and community organizer who spearheaded many of the ETT fights, not only for our rights, but against ongoing discrimination toward many at the utility, to expand affirmative action hiring of people of color and women, and especially women of color who are the most left out, even under affirmative action. She fought for fair employment and open housing in Seattle ordinances, and it was Heidi's untimely death in 2015 that led many people to contribute to the publication fund for this book and to FSP's determination to see this vital story told. I also want to salute Daisy Jones, one of the two black women ETTs, who was the first leader of our group, but was forced out after the first year when we were told that we would be laid off. As a mother with several children, she couldn't wait to be laid off. She had to go find a job. Because of being forced to quit, she was by law dropped from the affirmative action case to get her job back. And that's another example of how systemic racism operates in this society. I want to salute Terry Bach, who was the first female journey-level line worker at City Light and the only woman ETT to become one. Her six-year battle to achieve that was unrelenting. Then she turned around and became the first journey-level cable splicer. And finally, I want to salute Letha Neal, the other black woman ETT, who had the hardest fight to be recognized in her trade and was the last to reach journey level, becoming a cable splicer after many years of perseverance in the trade. And here I have to take a little detour, because the success of the program is really striking. Even though City Light management turned totally against us within our first 2 weeks on the job and effectively fired 8 of the 10 women after a little over a year, with the help of our successful discrimination suit, only 2 of the 10 women left the trade, and one of them switched to another trade, becoming a bus driver, and that was Daisy. All 8 of the rest reached journey level or higher jobs at City Light, and 7 had full 30-year careers at the utility. Wow. Even though the ETT program was never restarted, constant pressure from us to continue affirmative action hiring did raise the numbers of women and men of color at City Light and in Seattle generally for many years. So what, you may ask, made this level of success of the program possible? This book is unique in that it tells the whole gripping story. The secret was in the synergy of 2 elements that added up to be greater than the sum of their parts. One was a community of fighters, starting with the men of color who came before us as electrical trades trainees, the ones who made it through the gauntlet, I have to say, and then the multiracial group of 10 women trainees with 4 women of color, going on to embrace a whole community of people passionate about doing the right thing. This included courageous white male coworkers who had to stand up to intense peer pressure, women employees outside the trades, and a whole wider Seattle community that supported us in action. The other thing that is fairly unique is that the book tells about the role that political radicals played in the success of the fight. It's so unusual, both because radicals are often excluded from the get-go, also because when they are there, their role is usually hidden. This role was initially from the program's architect, Claire Fraser, who was a longtime labor organizer and affirmative action employment pioneer already. She learned her skills in the Trotskyist movement that also aspires to transform society. So we don't have to keep fighting these fights over and over again, please? She knew how to organize a fight to win and was always generous in teaching those skills far and wide. It was these 2 things, people who were fighters hooking up with people eager to teach the skills of fighting effectively that built the battle royale that this book is about. I want to tell you something of the structure of the book so you can see what an amazing achievement it is. It opens with the background of the period of the 70s, how it was impacted by the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, which won affirmative action hiring, which was implemented in federal contracts, federal and later local public employment, and college admissions. This was not some kind of special treatment, as its opponents claim. That would be the corrupt bribes for college for the rich that was just exposed in the media. Affirmative action was the recognition that those who have been systematically excluded need to be given the same chances that the more privileged have always had. After years of right-wing attack, this fight needs to be waged again because the doors of opportunity have been slammed shut almost as tightly as they were in the 50s. Ellie goes on to eloquently explain how the ETT program came about, how it was structured to succeed when so many programs of the time had limited success. The rest of the book details the fight from the competitive ETT hiring process to the Wildcat 11-day strike by virtually the entire City Light workforce only the month before we came on the job, to our first days at work when we took the side of the rebellious employees enraging the superintendent, to management's continuous attacks on the group and on Clara. It details the discrimination cases of the ETTs and Clara, and our victories and return to work, the ETTs in only a year, and Clara after a very long 7 years. It tells a little bit about the continuing organizing against discrimination and harassment in the 80s and 90s with the Committee for Equal Rights for City Life, and today with a new group founded in 2017, the Seattle Silence Breakers, which includes tradeswomen and also women and some men throughout city employment, fight not only sexual harassment, but race and sex and LGBTQ discrimination in city employment. And there are so many stories that Ellie tells from so many people's experiences. Here are just a few. Heidi's as an apprentice on the crew that pitted her, climbing up and down each pole with hooks on her legs, against two journeymen using a bucket truck and racing her to install streetlights on opposite sides of the road. She was literally running up and down the poles when one of her hooks hit a knot and kicked out, causing her to fall 23 feet. But then, immediately after word of this appalling accident went out to the crews, a lineman on my crew mocked Heidi and me, saying, "I hear your friend fall down, go boom." Yeah. There was ETT Jody Olvera having a coworker wait till she was standing in the back of a parked truck with the back door open, gun the engine, then slam on the brakes in an effort to make her fall out. But there are good stories, too. When Daisy Jones was being harassed with racist taunts, waiting till the whole crew was in the truck to lock them in. It was a hot day, too, by the way. Promising they wouldn't get out until they apologized and pledged to stop permanently. Needless to say, they got manners rapidly. The black tradesmen and other men of color who were essential early comrades in arms and who were literally our lifeline for survival. My black neighbor was a helper, gave me rides to work when we were assigned to the same service center, so I didn't feel isolated going into work those early days. Most importantly, it was mainly these men who were willing to give us the essential training we needed to be able to learn our jobs. And as you guys know, that's the key thing, people who actually teach you, right? It was black lineman John Harris who kept a later line apprentice, Sherry Holmes, from being thrown off a pole by a white lineman who didn't like her smart mouth. And there was Angel Arrowsmith's famous retort to a guy who was berating her as a very out lesbian. "I'm more of a woman than you'll ever have, and more of a man than you'll ever be." My personal stories include how I was outed as a Radical Women member on my first week on the cruise. "We heard you are a member of Radical Women." "Gasp, you're a women's liber?" I think they missed the fact that I was a socialist. That was nearly as important as being a feminist. An attempted frame-up by management of me and two other ETTs, Terry Bach and Jody Olvera, on manufactured charges of drinking on the job. That didn't get too far because, since it wasn't true, they didn't have any evidence. But they still managed to give Terry 3 days without pay for insubordination. Then there was the Radical Socialist Bitches label applied to the Radical Women members, Heidi, Terry, me, and Kathleen Merrigan, who was one of the second wave of women hires, by the IBEW union rep for City Light. When we heard of it, we turned the tables on him, embracing it, making RSB buttons, and wearing them to the next union meeting, offering them to our union brothers and their wives and daughters. They were a great hit. When the three former ETTs retired, the union gave us plaques of appreciation to their very own RSBs. And not least for me was becoming a power dispatcher with equal responsibility as my male co-workers over the electrical system and the work of the crews on it. The theme running through most of these stories is that we didn't sue our co-workers individually for their discriminatory behavior if we could help it. We confronted them directly and enlisted other co-workers and our union to support us. Legally, we held management responsible for creating a biased work environment. If they didn't promote and reward discrimination, it would stop tomorrow. Never forget that. The most rewarding part of this history for me was joining with others to fight for affirmative action, yes. Safety on the job, it's often the women and the people of color who are the ones saying that because they know that their lives are the most on the line. And overall workers' rights, which are always all wrapped up together in my experience. If you have a divided workforce, you have a weak workforce. These experiences has taught me is that it's always a good thing, and it's fun, to fight for your rights. We won't always win, but you can only win by fighting back. And even when we don't win, we have the pride of having fought a good battle. And that's a hell of a lot better feeling than thinking that you slunk away. So get this book and read it. You'll be glad you did.
The wonderful Megan Cornish. We were there and we continue to be our sheroes fighting the good fight against life-threatening sexism, against racism, against homophobic responses, xenophobia. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.